I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. Over the last few episodes, we've been looking at Lee Harvey Oswald's youth. We've seen that Oswald had a very tumultuous childhood. He moved around all the time, which must have made it hard to make and keep new friends. His mom wasn't exactly the warmest, most comforting lady, and by the time Oswald was entering junior high school, he was an only child, with both of his older brothers serving in the military. We've also seen a few discrepancies with timelines and locations when it comes to Oswald's whereabouts. I'm not exactly sure what this conflicting evidence means, but it does seem like, just when you have your head around Oswald's background and timeline, there's another anomaly to deal with. In this episode, we continue looking at Oswald's background before joining the Marines, including his jobs at 2 Jags Shipping Company and Pfisterer Dental Lab. We'll also take a look at whether Oswald showed any violent tendencies growing up.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed questioning the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Oswald entered his 10th grade year at Warren Easton High School in New Orleans in September of 1955. He dropped out of 10th grade before his 16th birthday, which was on October 18th. Shortly before leaving Warren Easton High School, Oswald brought a note from his mother asking for a copy of Lee's birth certificate and telling the school that the family was moving to San Diego. After he left Warren Easton, Oswald used a false affidavit written and signed by his mother, which said that he was 17 years old, which was the minimum age to enter the Marines. This, of course, was a lie because Oswald had really just turned 16 at the time. Somehow, the Marines found out about Marguerite's fraudulent affidavit and rejected Lee's enlistment. Marguerite told the Warren Commission that Oswald spent the next year reading and memorizing the Marine manual in anticipation of joining the Marines the next year when he actually turned 17. Oswald worked as a messenger at 2 Jags Shipping Company from November 10th, 1955 until January 14th of 1956, according to the Warren Report. Oswald then started work immediately at J.R. Michaels as an office administrator in January of 1956, but he only worked there briefly. After J.R. Michaels, Oswald then worked at the Pfisterer Dental Laboratory for a few months until ultimately leaving for Fort Worth in July of 1956, 3 months before Lee was eligible to join the Marines. But the Warren Commission testimony of Robert Oswald, Lee's brother, does not confirm the timeline of Lee's employment according to the Warren Report. When Robert arrived in New Orleans on July 15th of 1955 to visit his brother and his mom, he said that Lee was working at an export firm, which is another way to describe what Two Jacks did. But that would mean that Robert Oswald was off by 4 months compared to the time that the Warren Report said Lee Oswald actually started working at Two Jacks. Frank D. Benedetto, Oswald's former supervisor at Two Jacks, told the House Select Committee on Assassinations that, quote, Oswald worked at Two Jacks for a year to a year and a half. So his supervisor thought Oswald worked at Two Jacks for 12 to 18 months, whereas the Warren Report says Oswald worked at Two Jacks for a little more than 2 months. In 1955, just like today, all workers under age 18 were required to obtain a work permit from the Louisiana Department of Labor. Oswald did get a work permit when he was working at Dolly Shoe Store, but the FBI says that the Department of Labor did not have any work permits on file for Oswald's work at Two Jacks, J.R. Michaels, or Pfisterer Dental Lab. As a company that was a customs broker handling international shipments, Two Jacks was required to have all of their employees authenticated by the United States Customs. After the assassination, the FBI visited Doris Nakari, who was the head of the export control section within Customs and was responsible for broker employee authentications. Ms. Nakari said that she had no file on Oswald and did not otherwise remember him. You'll never believe this, but all of the payroll records for Oswald at Two Jacks have disappeared. There is a W-2 for Oswald in 1955 for Two Jacks, but it doesn't list any of the dates of employment. And there are also two handwritten payroll ledgers that the FBI says Mr. Two Jack provided to them. It's not possible to know who actually made these handwritten ledgers or when they were created. These ledgers are the thing that was relied on by the Warren Commission to determine the exact dates when Lee Harvey Oswald worked at Two Jacks. After Two Jacks, the Warren Report says that Oswald went to work for J.R. Michaels briefly. They don't say how long, starting in January of 1956, right after he left Two Jacks. J.R. Michaels was a shipping company, just like Two Jacks, and it was located one floor below Two Jacks in the same building at 442 Canal Street. But according to Oswald's former supervisor, D. Benedetto, Oswald never worked at J.R. Michaels at all. D. Benedetto said, quote, He couldn't have worked there. We're on the third floor of this building and they were one floor below us. We're in the same business. I was very good friends with Nick Mazza, the manager of J.R. Michaels, and I was in his offices nearly every day. We went to lunch together often and we were good friends. If Oswald had worked for Nick, I would have known it. DiBenedetto also calls into question the time of year when Oswald quit at Two Jacks. He said that he remembered it was hot outside at the time. This does not seem to match up with Oswald leaving Two Jacks in January of 1956. Nick Mazza, the manager of J.R. Michaels, told researcher and author John Armstrong that the FBI showed up at J.R. Michaels on Monday, November 25th, just a few days after the assassination, and asked him about Oswald's employment records. Mazza told the FBI that Oswald never worked at J.R. Michaels, but the agents told him that he needed to check the January 1956 payroll records. Now, how the agents knew to ask him for this information is not known. When Mazza actually checked the records, He found a canceled payroll check issued to Lee Oswald, dated January 20th of 1956. Mazza made a copy of this canceled check before giving it to the FBI. He provided a copy of the check to Armstrong. This check that Mazza gave the FBI has never surfaced in the National Archives or in any of the record declassifications over the years. According to the official story timeline, Oswald worked at the Pfisterer Dental Lab as a messenger for several months after his very short stint at J.R. Michaels. That means that Oswald should have been working at Pfisterer sometime between mid-January of 1956, right after he left J.R. Michaels, and July of 1956, when he and his mom moved back to Fort Worth. The lab made various dental items like crowns, bridges, and false teeth on behalf of local dental offices. And once these custom-made products were completed, a messenger boy would then deliver them to the local dentist office that placed the order. When Oswald started as a messenger boy at Pfisterer, he made fast friends with another messenger boy there, Palmer McBride. The FBI interviewed McBride the day after the assassination, and when they did, McBride gave the FBI the baffling testimony that Oswald worked at the Pfisterer Dental Lab with him from December of 1957 until April or May of 1958. That time range cannot be reconciled with the Warren Report's timeline of Oswald's life, which puts Oswald overseas in Atsugi, Japan for much of that period of time. Either the Warren Report is wrong or Palmer McBride is seriously mistaken on the timing. Let's dig a little deeper. McBride's certainty about the timeline is based on specific events that he can remember during his friendship with Oswald. For example, he told the FBI that Oswald came over to his house a few times where they both listened to classical music records. McBride's father worked at the New Orleans Opera House, and McBride recalled that he and Oswald once attended an opera called Boris Godunov. The only times that opera, Boris Godunov, played in New Orleans in the 1950s was on October 10th and October 12th of 1957. Like many of the records relating to Oswald's background, we have no original documents to establish when Oswald worked at the Pfisterer Dental Lab. All that we have is a 1956 W-2 form that shows that Oswald did work at the Pfisterer Dental Lab, and he was paid $612 for all of 1956. We have no specific payroll information, employment applications, performance reviews, or any other documents that would help put a timestamp on when exactly Oswald worked at Pfisterer. But we do have several other witnesses, aside from Palmer and McBride, who put Oswald working at the Pfisterer Dental Lab at about the same time as McBride does. Paul Fiorello worked at Pfisterer as a messenger boy from the spring of 1956 until 1966. He said that, quote, about a year to a year and a half after I started working at Pfisterer's, that's when Lee Harvey Oswald was hired. That timeline would equate to right around the second half of 1957, and not sometime from January to July of 1956, like the Warren Report says. Imelda Smith worked in the office at Pfisterer, and she remembered that Oswald and Palmer McBride would often argue about the merits of communism. She recalled them talking about the recent success that the Russians were having in the space race at the time. Now, for context, the Russians had two major space successes in the fall of 1957, the launch of Sputnik into orbit on October 10th, and putting the first dog into orbit on November 17th. There are no comparable Russian space successes during the first half of 1956 when the Warren Report says that Oswald was working at Pfisterer. McBride told the FBI that he also recalled arguing with Oswald about these Russian space successes, again, putting a timestamp on when Oswald was at Pfisterer with McBride. James Vance was close friends with McBride and was a member of the New Orleans Amateur Astronomy Association. Vance remembers meeting Oswald through McBride just a few days before the Astronomy Association held a special meeting at Vance's house to watch the first U.S. satellite be placed in orbit aboard Explorer 1. That historic satellite launch was on January 31st of 1958. In addition to the Astronomy Association meeting that was at Vance's house, McBride says that Oswald also attended an Astronomy Association meeting at the home of William Gerke in early 1958. When the FBI followed up with Gerke to confirm this timeline, he said that there were no Astronomy Association meetings that were held at his home until 1958. During that meeting at Gerke's house, Oswald spoke positively of communism and angered association member William Wolfe, who told Oswald, quote, "If you like Russia so damn much, why don't you just go over there?" When Wolfe was interviewed by the Warren Commission, he was asked whether he knew Oswald in 1955. His response was, quote, "1955? Yes, but it is sketchy. I really cannot say for sure. I could get the date from the Astronomy Club's records." But years later, when he was interviewed by John Armstrong, William Wolfe recounted the detailed timeline and said that he actually met Oswald sometime after Christmas of 1957, probably early January of 1958. Regarding his Warren Commission testimony, Wolfe said, quote, "I was just a kid, and I didn't think it mattered whether I met Oswald in 1955 or 1958. Also, for some reason, the employees of the Pfisterer Dental Lab were some of the earliest interviews that were conducted by the FBI. They interviewed three Pfisterer employees on November 23rd, three on November 24th, and four on November 25th. Now, I don't understand how all of these people can be wrong about the dates when Oswald worked at the Pfisterer Dental Lab, especially when the dates that they mention are anchored by these historical events, like Sputnik, a specific Astronomy Association meeting, or a traveling opera. They all have definitive timestamps that are not open to subjective interpretation. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. In July of 1956, Marguerite and Lee Oswald moved once again, this time back to Fort Worth, Texas. They lived at 4936 Collinwood. Robert Oswald had already been living in Fort Worth and moved in with his mother and brother Lee at Collinwood as soon as they got back to town. Having missed almost all of 10th grade the prior year while he was working in New Orleans, Lee Harvey Oswald enrolled in the 10th grade once again in September of 1956 at Arlington Heights High School. Oswald even tried out for the football team at Arlington Heights, but he was kicked off because he was not willing to run wind sprints when his coach told him he had to during practice. According to school records, Oswald dropped out of the 10th grade at Arlington Heights High School on September 28, 1956. Oswald turned 17 years old on October 18th of 1956, which finally made him eligible to join the Marines, so long as he had the parental permission. He got that permission from his mom, and on October 24th, Oswald signed his Marine Corps enlistment contract, bringing his education career to an end. Over the last few episodes, we've mostly focused on the timeline of where Oswald lived and where he went to school, but we haven't really talked about what Oswald was like as a person. What did people who knew Oswald while he was growing up say about him? Specifically, was he a violent kid? In episode 29, we talked about how Oswald was violent with his brother John Pick's wife and with his own mother. While Lee and Marguerite were staying in the cramped New York City apartment with his brother's family, Pick's wife, Marge, told Oswald to turn the volume down on the TV. Oswald then said no and threatened Marge with a knife. Then, when Marguerite intervened, 12-year-old Oswald punched his mom in the face. It was after this incident that Marguerite and Lee were asked to move out of the Pick's apartment. So that paints a pretty violent picture of young Oswald. But on the other hand, there are statements in the record from Oswald's time in New York that seem to suggest that he wasn't always violent. His brother, John Pick, whose wife had been threatened by Lee, told the Warren Commission, quote, "Things were pretty good during the time I was on leave. My wife liked Lee. My wife and I had talked several times that it would be nice if Lee would stay with us alone and we wouldn't mind having him." Oswald's probation officer in New York, John Caro, was assigned to him after he was found to be truant from school. Caro described Oswald as, quote, "a bright boy and a likable one." In the spring of 1954, when Oswald was attending Beauregard Junior High School, there was an incident that his homeroom teacher, Myra DeRouse, recalled where he was beat up by some other students. DeRouse said, quote, "Harvey didn't start a fight. He never started any fights. He had no fight in him whatsoever and would always walk away from a fight." Now, Marilyn Moret, Oswald's cousin, said that the reason he was in that fight is because he was riding the bus sitting next to a black student, which was not socially acceptable among some of the kids at Beauregard Junior High at that time. In the fall of 1954, Lee got into another fight with some other kids at school. When asked about that incident, his friend Ed Vobel told the Warren Commission, quote, "Lee never started any fights, but if you wanted to start one with him, he was going to make sure that he ended it, or you were going to really have one because he wasn't going to take anything from anybody." Here's Ed Vobel talking to a reporter just a few days after the assassination about this fight.
"Someone had punched him in the mouth that Oswald didn't know, I didn't know, and I don't think the boy even knew him. I think these boys that he had a fight with him put this other guy up to punch him in the mouth to get back at him, because Oswald did beat the other boys. And Oswald was laying down on the ground, and I ran up to him, and I think a couple other boys did too. And we brought him back into school and washed his mouth off and put some cold compresses on his mouth.
Now, not only did this fight require cold compresses, it was so serious that it might have resulted in Oswald losing a tooth. Oswald's friend Ed Vobel told the Warren Commission, quote, "I think he even lost a tooth from that. I think he was cut on the lip and a tooth was knocked out." Oswald's aunt, Lillian Moret, told the Warren Commission, quote, "There were boys in the back of him, and one of them called his name and said, 'Lee,' and when he turned around, this boy punched him in the mouth and ran, and it ran his tooth right through the lip. So his mother had to go over to the school and take him to the dentist, and I paid for that dentist bill myself." It's impossible to know just how violent Oswald was as a kid. There's a mixed record. He doesn't appear to have been out there consistently picking fights with other kids, although, according to Vobel, he could definitely hold his own if someone else wanted to fight him. Remember, we also have Dr. Hartogs in New York saying that Oswald had a, quote, "personality pattern disturbance with schizoid features and passive-aggressive tendencies." But that doesn't tell us anything about whether or not Oswald's guilty. However, there are two instances of Oswald saying that he wanted to kill the president of the United States. And that point does not look great for Oswald defenders. If you believe Henry Timmer, the guy who says he hung out with Oswald in North Dakota, Oswald told him, quote, "Someday I am going to kill the president." Timmer is certain about this statement because he was no longer allowed to play with Oswald after he told his mom what Oswald had said. On top of that, Oswald told his Pfisterer Dental Lab co-worker Palmer McBride that Eisenhower was exploiting the working people and that he would kill Eisenhower if he had the opportunity. One more point on Oswald's childhood. Robert Oswald wrote a book about his brother Lee in 1967. In that book, he said that Lee was obsessed with the TV show I Led Three Lives, which is the story of an FBI informant who posed as a communist spy. Robert said, quote, "In the early 1950s, Lee watched that show every week without fail. When I left home to join the Marines, he was still watching reruns." Now, this statement from Robert seems rather innocuous. So what? When Lee was a kid, he liked a certain TV show. Big deal. But the genesis of the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald was a deranged kid living in his own fantasy world who was obsessed with looking cool and being a spy partially comes from this statement by Robert Oswald. The problem is that Robert Oswald's statement is impossible. That's because the show I Led Three Lives debuted in September of 1953. But Robert Oswald left home to join the Marines on July 12th of 1952. Now, it would be easy to say that Robert Oswald was only off by a year, so what difference does it make? When we look at exactly what Robert is saying, it's that he remembered Lee was watching the show when Lee was growing up, which would be the period of time when Robert actually lived with Lee in Fort Worth before he moved to New York. But the show didn't exist at that time, so it's just not possible that Robert ever could have seen Lee watching that show at the time he says he did. Robert then says he remembered Lee watching reruns of I Led Three Lives in July of 1952, more than a year before the show even came out. Now, I don't know why Robert Oswald said this, but I don't think it's just a small mistake. It appears to be completely impossible. Maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't. Next time on Solving JFK, We'll have a bonus episode with Barbara Shearer, the director of JFK, What the Doctor Saw, a film that's out on Paramount Plus. Barbara was kind enough to invite me to be in the film, which is pretty awesome. Then we'll be off for a couple of weeks before returning to focus on Oswald's time in the Marines. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
I'm just happy.